Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. I imagine most of you have been here before, but if you're new, welcome. I don't know if you listened, but I reposted my Wayne Kramer episode. The amazing Wayne Kramer passed away a couple days ago, one of the great guitar players, a very important guitar player in a very important band who had thoroughly lived all nine of his lives. What an amazing guy that guy was. He spent time in prison, did a lot of charity work for the prisons, and if you really think about it, the MC5, that was really the beginning of it. That was the beginning of what became American kind of punk rock music. With no MC5, there's no Iggy Pop. And on through New York in the 70s and everything else. I just really love that guy, and I saw the MC5 on their last tour. I can't remember the guy who was singing, but it was really something. It's a really amazing thing. You know, I'm not a great guitar player, and it's an interesting thing what determines whether someone is great at anything. And a lot of times it's not about virtuosity. It's a weird thing I notice as I get older, that it's more about communicating your particular emotions, feelings, intent, voice, anything, whatever instrument you play. Because if you really listen to some of the greatest musicians or comedians or look at some of the greatest artists or any of it, that it's really about finding your voice, your sound, whatever it is that you lock into to communicate your truth is what makes somebody great, is what makes somebody a brilliant artist or a genius artist. Sometimes it's only three chords. Sometimes it's only a few nights. Sometimes it's only one style of painting. Sometimes it's only one book. Sometimes it's only a couple of movies. You start to realize back in the day, before the word content was even thought of as a delivery device of quote unquote self-expression, that there are people who maybe did one amazing novel, but it is so amazing, so transcendent or singular that was really enough. I mean, I can't speak to the lives that some artists live if they've only done one thing and they never quite were able to do another thing again, but what they left was amazing. And whether or not people know that or not, or whether or not as generations pass, they understand or contextualize or even listen or read or look at or feel what that artist put out there, it might get lost entirely, but that doesn't diminish its importance just because time moves on. Because something truly horrendous is happening in a lot of ways in terms of art and expression, that it really is about numbers, it's about clicks, it's about the draw. It seems that the idea of creativity in terms of what success means or what winning means is how much money comes in, how many clicks you get. It's really about the size. It's really about capitalism. It's really about everything that in some ways true art was working outside of. And I don't know what happens to all the marginal geniuses out in the world anymore. I don't know what happens. Sometimes they get appreciated later, or sometimes they just become a piece of a bigger puzzle that some people appreciate and some people don't know until someone says, hey, go listen to that. Go listen to MC5 Kick Out the Jams. Go put it into context. And then again, most people may never even get that context. It's a very strange thing as AI and technology and the facility and ability for individuals to operate in different delivery systems and work their asses off to constantly sort of infuse themselves into the cultural dialogue or try to. What gets lost is some essence of truth and some essence of real expression that is sometimes so simple and sometimes so singular and sometimes very fleeting. It's not about how many you can get up there, how many you can shoot, how many you can do. Whatever it is, it was not about that. It was about your persistence and your need to express yourself in a pure way that connects with at least a few people. It's not about the numbers, man. Anyway, welcome to the show. RIP, Wayne Kramer. Today on the show, I talked to Lori Kilmartin, who has been on the show before. She was on an episode, a full episode, 10 years ago, episode 472 from February 2014. She's been doing stand-up since 1987. She was a writer for Conan for years. She's written best-selling books, and she has a new special, Cis Woke Grief Slut. Very funny, always very funny, great joke writer, intense person. And oddly, I knew her up here where I am now in San Francisco. I first met Lori. She started up here and we sort of came up together in that period of my life. I am in San Francisco. That's why it sounds the way it does. And I have very mixed feelings about this place, not in an intellectual way. I literally feel mixed feelings when I'm up here. I don't know. I've been reflecting a lot on these different periods of my life because I start to realize as time goes on, even though I'm talking to a lot of people that have fairly kind of I don't want to sound condescending, but some people have structure in their lives that they really hold on to, and they've chosen a certain path for themselves that enables them to have a certain amount of security and sense of family and job regularity. And all those things that sort of justify a relatively comfortable existence, that's what they're going for. They want to be happy enough. They want to do enough of what they like to do. And they want to feel a certain amount of connection and emotional love and support from whatever family they're building. I mean, there's just a way of life. And it's not necessarily status quo. It's just it's completely understandable. But it's also not a life I ever lived in my life. But as I get older and as I do more stage work, I start to really think about what is my life? You spend your time as a comic talking to a general audience. And if you really start to think about the people that you're talking to, yeah, we have emotional connection. We have similarities. If you're a creative person, an angry person, a hypersensitive person, a selfish person, whatever it is that connects people to me and my audience, I connect with people. But I do find that when I really think about it, my life is bizarre. And it always has been. There's been several cities that I've lived in, several periods of drug use and not drug use, several periods of relationships with people, several hundred road gigs. It's a strange thing, the reality of the life of a comic or of an artist, where you really are outside of the norm, and then you have to seek the broader spectrum of people to be your audience and to relate. And I don't think I've ever aspired to saying like, well, here's a life that everyone can relate to. I've had to figure out how to do my comedy in a way, well, this is what I think, because I know most of you are not going to necessarily relate to my life, maybe in terms of relationship, food, issues, drugs, trauma, but it's not, I don't have the kids, I don't have the wife, I don't have the job, I don't have a sort of consistency of emotion, but I'm starting to realize I lived a life, I'll tell you that. And it keeps going. Portland, Maine. I'm at the State Theater on Thursday, March 7th, Medford, Massachusetts, at the Chevalier Theater on Friday, March 8th, Providence, Rhode Island at the Strand Theater on Saturday, March 9th, Tarrytown, New York at the Tarrytown Music Hall on Sunday, March 10th, Atlanta, Georgia, I'm at the Buckhead Theater on Friday, March 22nd, Madison, Wisconsin at the Barrymore Theater on Wednesday, April 3rd, Milwaukee, Wisconsin at the Turner Hall Ballroom on Thursday, April 4th, Chicago at the Vic Theater on Friday, April 5th, Minneapolis at the Pantages Theater on Saturday, April 6th, Austin, Texas at the Paramount Theater on Thursday, April 18th as part of the Moon Tower Comedy Festival. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour for tickets. San Francisco. The drive up here was amazing. I don't know about you, but when I drive, it's weird. I don't listen to anything. Is that weird? I mean, I'll listen to a little music, but sometimes I'll just drive and think. And when I tell people that, they're like, what? And I'm like, yeah, I don't even think to listen to music. I just drive and think. It's a meditative quality where, you know, driving is innate if you've been doing it all your life. So your body is sort of taken care of and your brain can just go. It's almost meditative. But I do a lot of thinking. I'm not saying it's good thinking. I'm not saying they're happy thoughts, but it runs the gamut. Whoo! So I get to San Francisco and it feels not unlike many of the places I've been in my life where things happened in my development, that it feels a bit traumatic. There is this sort of coming back to places that you were before that had some baggage to them. And part of you goes back to that. I had to do a show at the Castro last night, the Castro Theater. I've been here several times, obviously, since, but I never felt that they were as good a shows as I could do. And I kind of blame the venues. It was kind of true. I did a show at Symphony Hall many years ago, which was huge. I did a show at the Masonic, which was also huge. But the Castro Theater is this historic, amazing place. Seats about 1,400. We sold it out. And the entire day, I was like feeling like I felt when I lived here. Like, I don't know who I am. What am I doing? You know, am I, you know, is San Francisco, can I, these people are so far along in their self-discovery. I'm not going to be able to connect. I like literally deconstructed my entire sense of craft, self, and I got into this, you know, strange, you know, hyper, you know, insecurity. And right up to when I went on stage, I was with Taylor Williamson and I was like, fuck. And he's like, oh my God, you still go through this? You can't, why are you doing this? You're weird. You know, like he's like, and I'm like, no, sometimes this is the process, man. And I got out there and it was just, it took a minute to get into it, but like once I was in the groove of what I do, it was like, oh my God, I'm back here doing comedy in a place that had a profound impact on how I do comedy. And you know, I kind of got in the pocket and it was fucking great. It was fucking great. The Castro Theater is a beautiful venue. It's changing hands. It was the last show that they were going to do before the renovation. And it was one of those situations where the guy's really excited about the renovation. He showed, it was always a movie theater. It was a silent theater that became a sound theater. And it, there, he showed me the screen behind the screen for the original silent theater that they eventually took out. And then they punched holes into the walls, you know, behind the original screen to put the giant speakers in for the sound movie, for the talkies. And they found the old curtain that went over the original proscenium. So they're going to do this amazing renovation. I know it's a delicate point for people in the city because of the history of the area and of the city. But it might be nice. I found it to be a beautifully haunted old venue, like many of them are. And it felt like the Castro was still, you know, just pumping and vital and still, you know, very gay and very lively and really what it's supposed to be. It wasn't daytime, but it was nice to be back there. I hadn't been in that theater since I saw movies there when I lived here in the 90s. So all in all, pretty good. Pretty good trip. And my foot, I was hobbling around with my boot. I'll tell you, man, this boot business with the broken foot, it's playing on me. You know, I'm feeling a little sedentary. Last week I did exercise, but here's the one thing I didn't really realize, and I should have, is that, wow, after a week with a sock on in a boot without taking it off, there's a bit of a stank. Like it started to smell like my foot was gangrenous. So I had to just bite the bullet, almost literally, and carefully take the boot off, carefully unroll my sock, carefully put a new sock on. Just, I guess it's vanity, but you don't want to be places where you're just emitting this horrendous stench from your bad foot. But I think I pulled it off. I don't think I fucked with anything. All right, look. So Lori Kilmartin, I love her. I've worked with her on and off for years. She was always Eric Conan. She's opened for me before. She's a great comic. Her new special is called Cis Woke Grief Slut, which you can buy or rent now on digital platforms like Apple, Amazon, and YouTube. Go to LoriKilmartin.com for links. And this is me talking to my old friend Lori.
Sometimes I wish I paid more attention in school, or in some cases, any attention at all. There are probably a lot of things I could have gotten more out of, like literature, and now it's probably not in the cards to go back to school and study the classics. But luckily for us, there's a new podcast called The Foxed Page that dives deep into the best books of all time. This is basically like the best possible college English class, but more relaxed and fun. No pressure of grades or needing to prepare something to say in class. It's only the books you want to read and know about, presented by best-selling author Kimberly Ford. Everything from Cormac McCarthy to Madame Bovary, from classics like Frankenstein to modern hits like Lessons in Chemistry. I love Ireland, but I missed the boat on James Joyce. The Foxed Page has a three-part series on Dubliners, and that's a pretty great starting point. Want to get the most out of what you read? The Foxed Page is for you. Get it now wherever you get your podcasts.
Most of this stuff that was in that garage is upstairs in my sort of office room in the house. All the books and all that shit.
Yeah.
I just, when I got this place, I'm like, do I want to do that? Do I want to put all that back out here? It didn't, it seemed organic in the other place.
Right.
So now I just have random shit from the old house. So it's without context, but the desk looks similar.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
But what do you do with all that stuff of a lifetime, you know? Like,
throw it away. I mean,
I guess so.
You've gone through enough death of,
yes,
of people.
But
what did you do with it?
It's more like my parents' stuff and things that mean something to you. But like career stuff. Like, I guess I have a lot of laminates from festivals keep around a teddy bear from my childhood.
Yeah.
But there's not a ton of stuff. But you have tons of cool memories from just this podcast.
Sure. And I have all those laminates too. Like hundreds of them.
Yeah.
And they're hanging there up there.
Yeah.
And they become, well, what I noticed in the old garage is it started to look like an unattended roadside museum. Where, you know, there's just cobwebs happening and shit. And I was like,
people will come by, talk to you for an hour, then leave.
Right. That's right. But all the artifacts were just getting dusty and weird.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And when I got them all out and I cleaned them up, I mean, I still like looking at them, but I wonder when that shit loses meaning. I mean, I'm 60.
Yeah.
And there's part of me that's sort of like, is it time to just throw this shit out?
Right. But it will have meaning to other people that love your podcast.
I guess so.
It will.
It will have meaning. Mm-hmm. So what are you saying? Maybe get the Smithsonian to step in?
Yes. Maybe. Sotheby's have a WTF auction? Come on.
I've talked about there are people that do this, where the papers of somebody will get, will be taken up by a college or a library, or somebody catalogs all this shit.
Yeah.
And I've talked about it before, but people have stepped up. You know, I'm an archivist. I'll do it. And I'm like, I don't know, man.
Wow.
I was up in this attic. There's an attic up in this house, in this garage, looking at my old poetry and shit. I'm like, does anyone need that?
No one needs it, but somebody wants it.
I don't know, man. Because that guy Fine Arts is doing a doc on me. And we're going through stuff. I'm like, I don't need anyone to see this. Really? But what I found, though, is that, you know, when Lynn passed away, it was like, and she was, you know, my age. So there, I knew all this stuff. I could tell this stuff. She kept much of the same stuff that I kept.
Yeah.
You know, writings, papers, bits and pieces. And there was boxes and boxes of it. And it was during COVID.
Yeah.
And it was like, well, who's going to do what's going to happen to this?
Right, right, right.
And I didn't have enough history with her to really make any decisions around that. So friends came down, and, you know, a lot of it just, you know, it gets thrown away.
Yeah, right, right, right.
And because no one actually really wants it.
Yeah, right.
I mean, some of it, the things that people wanted, they took. But then there's other stuff.
Yeah. I mean, with my parents, neither of them like were journal writers, which
right.
probably harmed my childhood, but, you know, because they no reflection.
Right.
But they didn't leave a bunch of stuff like that. Like, I know my kid is just going to have piles of me notebooks.
Yeah.
Of me complaining about various bookers of the day.
Right. But does he give a shit?
I hope he doesn't.
I don't know who, even though we have these legacies or that we think that people want them. But I mean, have you ever looked at that kind of shit? I mean, I have a few things of Lynn's and I'm like, I'm not going to go through it. Not because I don't care. It still doesn't feel correct.
Well, I mean, there are whole presidential libraries that exist that people never go to. And these people were the presidents. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Who the fuck is going to those? And for what reason? I think when people do research.
Yeah.
That then it becomes something. But I would imagine most people could just do research online. But there are some people that do the real shit.
Yeah.
And they go to the sort of look at the collection or the estate or the stuff of a president or anybody that research. Like, do you have Mark Maron's poetry from high school? Some of the original stuff?
Have you you worked Dr. Grin's in Grand Rapids, right?
I don't think I did.
Oh, it's right next to it's right near the Jerry Ford Museum or the library. And I went and it's pretty awesome. He and Betty Ford in their youth were among the most attractive people I've ever seen.
Pretty hot?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And why was it awesome? Because it actually put him into a context that you could never really see him in. When we were young or he was alive.
Yeah, he was just a Chevy Chase joke to me.
Yeah,
and
right.
I was like, oh, he was the most powerful man in the world for about a year and a half, or 2 years maybe, right?
Oh, he didn't make the second term? That was
it? No. That's when Carter took him down, right?
No kidding.
Yeah.
So he filled in for Nixon and didn't even go this. He couldn't pull off.
Nope.
I didn't remember. Wow.
Yeah.
But he's still got a library.
A full library.
And Betty Ford has a drug center. I imagine in the big picture, that's done much more good than the Jerry Ford library.
Her legacy is, I think, more secure or important than his.
Where the hell did I play in Grand Rapids? Some church-ish looking place. They have a theater. It's a bigger venue.
Is it downtown?
It's
probably right next to Dr. Grin's.
Right. It's a folk. It was big with folk music back in the day. I think it was an old church.
Oh, okay.
It was kind of an odd room.
Yeah.
Isn't the DeVos family from Grand
Rapids?
Yeah,
they are. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She's all over that town.
And that's the Amway. Is that Amway?
Amway. And then her brother is Eric Prince. He's like a mercenary,
Blackwater?
Halliburton. That guy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Blackwater
that.
Man.
Yeah,
yeah.
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 I think that's the guy.
Yeah. It's just a multi-pronged evil family.
Sure. And they are proud to be involved.
Yeah.
You know, that's their business.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's a very odd thing to realize. And I've had this realization lately. And I think, and you probably have too, because I see it in some of your material, that, you know, no matter how we judge these people, the other side or whatever it may be, most of them believe it. So it's not like you can just educate them and be like, you guys are being dumb and evil.
Yeah.
They're like, no, you don't get it. We believe this. Like all the abortion material you do.
Yeah.
That it's not going to be absorbed by people who are anti-abortion because they think they're doing something godly and righteous.
Sure. I mean, if I believed a fetus had the same value as a human life, I would act that way too, I'm sure.
But we don't.
But they're also safe in their place with their people, and they have a home.
Yeah.
And why would they leave it when
when
all their Facebook friends are telling them you're great, you're awesome,
and they might win?
Yeah,
and they seem to be winning.
They've had some great wins.
Yeah,
it's
disturbing. But I for some reason and maybe it's just growing up that I realize like you know this is the way the world works. These monsters. Fascists or people that are driven by religion or nationalism, a lot of times they win. And in most countries in the world, they kind of have won. And it's not because it bothers me that I used to believe that like, well, there's got to be a way to sort of bridge the gap. And there isn't.
Right.
There's no teaching them.
Yeah.
And because they think we're monsters.
Yeah.
And I understand I'm empathetic to their position.
That's the wonder is like, it's a push pull. And you would think like after World War II, you know, we're done with fascism.
Right.
Like,
no.
Or you would think, I don't know. I just thought we had so many wins, like with gay rights and abortion rights. You
right.
know, it's like, oh, that's settled. None of it's settled. it could all be taken away. And there are people that want to take it away that think it was unsettled when we thought it was settled.
That's right. You know? They don't believe in liberal democracy.
Right.
They don't. There's a whole spectrum of autocratic and nationalistic beliefs. But that's why we had to defeat fascism.
Yeah.
And why it was a long war, because a lot of people were like, we want it.
Yeah.
And it's hard to fathom that.
Yeah.
But they want it. It's like they think that what we believe is too permissive,
mm-hmm.
and they want rules and they want control.
It feels like it kind of like when we were studying World War II, it almost felt like a switch that was flipped off, right?
Yeah.
Like, oh, they got really fascist and crazy for a little bit.
Yeah.
And now it's, you know, they're cool. West Germany, whatever, you know, they're our greatest ally in democracy. They loved
it. Starting to thrive, trying to thrive.
But it's obviously a switch that can be flicked back on pretty easily, too.
Well, it was just a long shot.
Undercurrent in a lot of people.
I think democracy was a long shot. It's like, to maintain it,
right.
Because it requires tolerance.
Yeah.
And now that's fucking gone.
Yeah.
So now what? Now you just double down on whatever you think and fuck you.
Yeah.
There's no kind of moral, you know, precedence that people feel like they have to honor. That's a big, and I guess we're not really talking about stand-up here, but but we are to a certain degree because, you know, I really like the new special. It's great.
Oh, thanks.
It's very funny. Good jokes, powerful, dark, good punchers.
Yeah. I try to throw a few good punchers in there, Mark.
No, you always do. But I mean, I've noticed that there's not a lot of pushback from the side of what's considered woke. You know, I make fun of anti-woke comics.
And, yeah.
But ultimately, we don't get the same attention.
No.
Because there's no organized, you know, hackneyed, ideological point of view that we're all abiding by, which is what they do.
And it wouldn't be fun to be a part of.
Oh, no, of course not. But I find that, like, lately, like, I talked to Jacqueline Novak the other day.
I just listened to that one yesterday.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
It's good.
It was great.
And I'm talking to you, and I talked to, like, a few other comics. There are comics who don't consider that they're not presenting themselves as woke, but, you know, we just do aggressive shit.
Yeah.
Some people do aggressive shit.
Yeah.
And that, like you do.
I feel like I would be called that, so I'll just do it myself.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we can call ourselves that. But the truth of the matter is that your comedy or Novak's comedy are pushing more boundaries and more taking more risks than any sort of anti-woke asshole. So this is actually the reaction to it.
Mm-hmm.
Just good, solid, dirty, dark shit.
Yes. I mean, that's what comedy is. It's weird to talk about material instead of just doing material, you know? Like when a bunch of comics start talking about trans women, and it's the same premise.
Totally.
And it's the same point of view. And good comics. And you're like, why are you all going to a meeting?
They are.
And coming up with this idea. Maybe that's what podcasts are in a way. But like those, you know,
I think it's the information bubbles. I mean, it's where it's who's prioritizing that information.
Right.
And those, there's a certain worldview situation going on among podcasters and some news outlets where that's what's being talked about every day.
And from one point of view.
Right.
And it's.
But why is it even being talked about every day?
It's like, that's not you. It's not anyone in your family. It's not your business.
Right.
Why are you into it? And why are you all into it the same way?
That's
the
weird thing.
Yes.
I
would never have even talked about trans women, but I was like, what is happening? Is no one else have any other point of view? Is there a point of view where they can exist? It's great. We're allies.
Yeah.
Let's hold hands and go for it.
Yeah.
Like, where is that? So
just,
that's what I
just
wanted.
Just fucking relax.
Yes.
And be tolerant, for God's sake. It's not the end of the world.
Yeah. Sorry, I got all.
But I noticed that. I was at the Comedy Store, and I saw a comic that we both know, a woman. And like at some point in her act, she goes, well, I guess I got to do my trans stuff now. And I'm like, no, you don't. You really don't.
You don't.
Because there's someone else doing it down the hall.
Yeah.
It's not that different.
I want to hear from trans comics more than anyone else about what it's like to be trans. And they don't all have the same point of view, you know?
And they don't have a as big a microphone.
Correct.
And also, but there's a lot of that going on. But we all have our audiences now. There's no broader, you know, we're not all speaking to the same people anymore.
Right.
Which makes it sort of a dumb game.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's no longer, there's no... kind of collective processing.
Right, right.
It's just like, fuck you over here and fuck them over there. It's just, it's sort of sad. Even within, like, who was I talking to? Somebody recently about, oh, it was that comic historian. Jesse David Fox.
Yeah,
and he was talking about this whole world of LGBTQ comedy that Bo and Yang came out of, and that was sort of an organized, or at least a niche kind of movement in New York, and I don't know anything about it. And he turns out that he turned, like, he got real funny, that Bo and Yang.
Oh, he's great.
He's great. But at the beginning of that of SNL, I'm like, I don't know who this guy is, and he's doing okay. But now he's like the best thing on there.
Oh, yeah.
It's crazy. But there are voices out there. I just don't know where they are, and I'm not exposed to them a lot.
I think they're all over LA as well.
Sure.
Smaller little shows.
I'm not getting out to them, but I'm glad they're out there.
But do you ever want to pop in on their shows? Like, you wouldn't have to be announced as Marc Maron. You could just do a spot at Permanent Records outside.
I've done that.
Yeah.
It's fun, right? It's okay. I mean, they're...
You get to see comics you wouldn't see, and kind of, you know, they're the ones setting the tone, and the audience.
The younger comics.
Yeah, coming up are you know, they're that's where comedy's going to go. So it's good.
I'm hoping it doesn't go the other way. It seems like the bullies are kind of shifting the cultural dialogue. It's kind of problematic.
Maybe they're bringing their audience into comedy.
They're building an audience. Whereas, you know, I'm sort of been a little spoiled. In the sense that, like, I now can play for mostly my audience, which is nice.
It's wonderful.
It's okay, but I like going to the Comedy Store where half the people are like, I don't really fucking know this guy.
Yeah.
That's the job.
I still
hold on to that.
You got to do both. I mean, at your level, when you can have that audience that's there ready to accept everything you say, it is good. It's smart for you as a stand-up to keep doing spots where you have to follow
people. Of course. Yeah, just keep doing the work. But sadly, there's part of me that wants to push away the people that... But just want to hear what I've just... Oh,
you want to repel them? Uh-oh.
Yeah, a little bit. I want to challenge the people that love me. That's
well,
what
they
I
can't
do.
Be right. If they love you, they can't be correct.
Right? I don't. What the fuck do they know?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's been the problem in my life. But have you had to deal with clubs where you're doing jokes and you get vocal or kind of any sort of resistance?
I don't like get super. I find if you can do like quote like liberal material without if you don't mention Biden.
Yeah.
That seems to be the word they hook onto.
Oh, right.
You know what I mean? Otherwise, they're like, well, maybe she loves abortion, but she's also conservative.
Right.
Like, you know
or
what I mean?
It's still idea-based, and they hear it as ideas.
Yeah, as a bigger thing. And the word Biden or a few maybe other Democratic words are red meat, and then they completely turn against you.
But I mean, what exactly happened with the abortion joke?
That was just some dumb. It wasn't even a good joke. It was just some dumb little riff.
That's the funniest part of the special. It's not the funniest part, but I think it's a very comedian thing where you're like, I wish it was a better joke.
I have better structured jokes you could get mad over, not this dumb
riff,
like, right?
You're like a structured person. So you just put out this kind of okay joke.
Yeah, and the fact that I have to re-say it, you know, when I would rather fix it is really annoying. But, I just said it on a Sunday night MSNBC show by Amen. It was the weekend that they had leaked the draft overturn Roe.
Oh, yeah, right.
And it was just a dumb little line. And then it went viral on right wing.
What was the line?
Oh, come on. Don't make me.
Well,
all right. It was... I hope the leaker's a Republican because I'm going to find him, have sex with him, and joyfully abort the fetus.
Sure.
That's it, okay? It's just, it's not a joke. It's a riff, a tiny rifflet.
Sure. Yeah,
okay?
It's just a fuck you.
Yeah. And so that little line, I had better jokes that they didn't clip.
Yeah.
From that.
Yeah.
They took that, and then that went all over, and it got up to.
Clickbait.
Yeah, total clickbait. Yeah. It went on to Mediaite, which is this clip site that, you know, everyone grabs and gets mad over. Went all the way up to Sean Hannity's show on Fox News.
Yeah.
And then they replayed it. And then Sean Hannity, Lara Trump, and Pam Bondi, the former Attorney General of Florida, disgust me.
Yeah.
It was so bizarre.
Monsters.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just like a panel of monsters.
Completely, completely.
Disgusting.
This is what liberals do. They joyfully, you know, I get that it wasn't a great joke, so maybe you didn't get it was a joke.
Sure.
But do you really think that I'm going to be doing that?
Seems like a lot of times they don't get their jokes. They don't get that these are jokes.
No.
Because they don't have the switch in their head that registers what that point of view says as ever being funny.
Right. I will say that whoever clipped it out, and I think it was MSNBC and put it on Media, they labeled it guest says instead of comedian says,
right.
Which of course is going to get people to be angrier. I think if they knew that I was a comic and not some, you know.
But there's the fact that their brains are so compromised.
Yes.
That they can't see joke tone.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
They're also unwilling to, like, they'd rather get all worked up and take things seriously than just say, like, that's not funny.
Yeah.
But, like, I get plenty of people saying, I've never been funny. I'm not funny. I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
I can take that. But to sort of register this as some sort of ideological truth.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It is. It is. And it was a crazy couple days of threats people finding me.
How bad were the threats?
I called it Cis Woke Grief Sled. I think a church got together and just sent me the same email, called me a sled. There was a guy, I replied to a bunch of people too.
Yeah.
I will reply to negativity.
I can't.
And
I won't.
A guy.
On Twitter?
No, he emailed me about abortion. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I said, I disagree. And then he said, you seem like you're.
Oh, no. He thought he had you on the hook.
No, he goes, he came back friendly. He goes, you seem like you're like an expert on computers. And all I had done is reply to his email. And I can show you the email. This sounds like I'm making it up. But he said, I'm getting a lot of ads with gay pornography on my browser and I can't figure out how to get rid of it. And obviously, he's looking at gay porn.
Yeah.
And I said maybe like a handyman or somebody's, you know, accessing your computer. Yeah. So you might want to check that out. And he thanked me. And that was it. So another fan converted.
Oh, my God. That was it's so scary for certain, you know, older people.
Yeah. But I think people can contact you and send you stuff because they don't think you're going to reply. They don't think you're a real person or they think you have a team or something.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
They always assume that someone else is reading it or that you're not going to reply.
Yeah.
And I generally don't. But the times I have to things that trigger me.
Yeah.
I'd say 50-50 people come back on, oh, man, I'm sorry. I didn't think you were real. Or
right.
That you were
gonna
come. I mean, I get what you're saying. You know, it's just this initial kind of like, rah, 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 rah.
Yeah.
And then you're like, hey, man, take it down a notch. You're like, oh, God, I'm done.
Yeah.
I didn't know you were going to say anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so it went away, though, pretty quickly?
It did. Yeah. After about 4 or 5 days. It might bubble up again now, but, you know.
Everything just sort of does that.
I know.
If you're lucky.
Yeah.
It just kind of goes crazy for a few days, and then it just doesn't matter. Undertow just gone.
Yeah. Well, it's crazy to me is like I was just joking about abortion. I wasn't like I said I had an abortion or I was providing them. Like this is what I got from making just like a dumb little line.
They just have nothing to talk about.
Yeah.
It's just they just make it, you know, they just make hay out of everything.
Well, sure. I mean, MSNBC makes a show and then Fox News makes a segment out of that. And maybe MSNBC makes a segment out of that. And it's just a cycle of segments. And how much ingesting all this knowledge, I guess it's good to be educated. But also how much can you do to change things?
Well, that's the big question.
And holding
right?
all of that in you, what's it do to you all day long, you know?
Are you asking me? Because I'm trying to figure that out. What have you found for yourself?
Well, you know, since I stopped working on Conan, I've been allowed to not pay attention to all the details, right? And I feel like if I was still working for Conan, still writing monologue jokes, I would know, I would understand all the charges that Trump is undergoing in this specific trials because there's so many.
Yeah.
And now I'm just kind of... You know, he's a monster. He's guilty.
Yeah.
I hope the Justice Department, I hope the system works.
Yeah. Well, we're going to find out.
Fingers crossed.
That fucking guy's got some pretty, he definitely has some pretty good timing somehow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But you also included that stuff. I mean, I guess I haven't talked to you since. I think I talked to you about when your dad died, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
About that book.
Yes. Yeah. Dead People Suck. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, right, right.
But now, like, you've changed your tune with your mom.
I was totally heartbroken when my dad died. Yeah. And I was conflict. I mean, yes, it's my mom, of course. We had a, she lived with me. She's a Trump supporter. We had a lot of arguing. And I guess I thought when I moved her in with me, like we would, the proximity, we would fix everything, you know? And it we just fought as hard. We went to two sets of therapies together.
Really?
The first one with Dr. Steve.
Oh, yeah.
And she walked out after 10 minutes of the first one. And then the second one, it was, I went for an hour and she went for an hour and then we met or something. And it didn't really help.
See, this is, but this is interesting because we were talking about the idea of realizing that there's no way to get through.
Right.
That there is no bridge. And this is like, this was how, was a lot of it ideological?
I don't even know. It was, yes. I mean, it all stems from that, but it was, you know, mother-daughter stuff, parent-child stuff. And the, you know, like me just wishing she would change, like, and thinking maybe with, it, when my dad gone and me being like the primary person around her, I could sort of break her down a little bit. And instead she got more hardened.
Like, you know? What were the main issues? Out of curiosity.
Oh my gosh. Aside from politics?
Do you have sisters or brothers?
I have a sister, yeah.
Yeah, and how's she feel about your mom?
It's very similar.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's standard parent stuff.
It's parent stuff.
Your parents weren't together, or they were?
They were together.
Oh, they
but
were.
Like, my mom, one time, she had stuff happen to her. She never went to therapy, highly traumatizing things.
And as
she
a child?
Yeah, swallowed it and just went on as her generation did.
Right.
And me just wishing, because maybe things were overlooked in my childhood because that was her nature was to overlook pain. Thinking, if you had been in touch with that, you may have recognized it happening to me, and maybe it wouldn't have happened as badly as it did.
So she couldn't even process her own trauma.
No.
Unwilling.
No, she was very much outside of it. And I remember we were watching
Dissociated.
Yes, we were watching Hoarders, one of the hoarding shows.
Yeah.
And something about it, she goes, oh, a guy molested me when I was 4 in the bushes in Tennessee. I was like, what?
That was brought on by hoarders?
Yeah, and maybe it was in Tennessee. It was something where like, oh.
Wow.
And you're just recalling it now and not crying, no pain, just like, huh. Like it was just an old movie that was playing that it popped up again. And I was like, ah, that's like the way that how she remembered and how she treated it, that horrible event was like, oh, okay.
That really
explains a lot of how she, you know, kind of raised us a little bit, you know?
And sure. And and also, you know, that type of dissociation is, you know, you kind of build some sort of emotional system around that.
Yes.
I mean, I try to talk about this whole world of trauma processing stuff and being able, but I think everybody compartmentalizes it.
Of course,
I guess the real problem is if you've compartmentalized it and it's just a monster in a room, you know, pounding to get out and ruining everything in the whole building because you're not giving voice to it or you're not. I
guess she was so depressed. But never so much she was incapacitated. Joseph's constant lack of joy around us, maybe.
But also she has, obviously, a vulnerability to grievance-driven ideology.
Yeah.
And that's probably directly related to trauma.
Definitely. I just wanted her to cheer up
and
be lighter in her final years, which was ridiculous because she missed my dad like crazy. And she's left her home and she's left everything. And she's living in a little room with me, her hostile daughter, and her only ally, her grandson, you know?
Her only ally.
Yeah.
You liked her?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know,
well,
I mean,
good.
She could be a little, you know, nag a bit, which would annoy him. But I think sometimes I'm like, oh, he picked up some antipathy from me, you know, even though I tried to hide it, you know?
So when you went to therapy, whether you were trying to get at that trauma and stuff?
I didn't think of it that way. I just wanted us to get along better. But I realized after she died, and you always realize stuff after they're gone, and then you want to talk to them again. It's like, hey, I figured us out.
Yeah.
So let's go back.
Yeah.
That there was there was just like such a heaviness around her.
Yeah.
As a child, you just want them to giggle.
Sure.
a lightness. Yeah. And hers had been, you know, it was going before my dad died. And then after he died, you know,
it just went away.
Yeah.
And you don't think it was like chemical depression? Or
could be.
Yeah.
Could be.
But definitely depression.
Yeah.
So now, like, because when I remember during COVID, when she started dying of COVID, that it was like there were like up to the hour updates, it seemed.
Yeah. It was such a weird time. And it was, I think at that time, it was the only time somebody, not to like, you know, I might have been one of the first to live tweet it, the whole thing going down.
Someone
as
dying
opposed
of COVID?
To after they had died and what it was like.
Yeah, no, it was important.
It was really wild.
Yeah.
And once she was taken to the hospital, she was in a rehab center. That's where she got COVID, Dishkirt Hospital. They set up an iPad. And we kept, you know, I kept mine on. My sister came down and we had her like on, like mom TV, you know.
Yeah.
You know, six days straight, maybe, you know, except for when we were bumped off, but then we call back and get back on.
Uh-huh.
And we just kept talking to her. It's an iPad, take it around the house, tell her what we're doing. My Aunt Patty, her sister, called and talked to her for like 2 hours straight with no response, which is like my classic. Right. That's an Aunt Patty move.
Yeah, yeah.
She could talk for 2 hours straight. And
that was like from her getting COVID to her dying of it. How long?
It was
that
a week. Been? It was a week.
Really?
Well, she was old, you know, and she got it. She got the alpha version, I guess, unmitigated version, no vaccine in June of 2020. So it took her out pretty quick. But she was unconscious the whole time. My sister and I did get to visit her after we lobbied the hospital. We were dressed head to toe in like a beekeeper's outfits.
Yeah.
Plastic gloves, couldn't touch her. And she kind of raised her body up and looked up and then went back down. So that was the only time she moved the entire time on her own when we were watching her on the iPad. So we knew she knew we were there.
Yeah.
I don't know if she knew she had COVID. I don't know what she knew. She was on morphine.
Yeah.
And, you know, who knows? I hope she was just seeing visions of my dad and her mom welcoming her to wherever.
So at that time, where were we all at culturally with COVID? So the fight was about masks.
I think so. I mean, Gavin Newsom, he lightened the mask requirement over Memorial Day weekend. And I think that's when my mom caught it, you know? In rehab centers, it's all part-time workers. They're all bopping around from place to place. I would rather
rehab centers for what?
Die on a beach than go to a rehab center.
You mean what, for
like
aging?
Like skilled nursing facility. So it's like if you have a broken hip or something.
Why was your mom in one of those?
I had taken her to the hospital the previous week because she was struggling to breathe.
Yeah.
And so they just kept her there. They got her back to normal. But when you're old, if you're in bed for a week, you need lessons to learn how to walk again. So what I should have done is brought her home and had a nurse come in.
Yeah.
But I was like, you know, at that time, they're like, well, it's safe. You know, the governor has, you know, modified some of the things we have to do to avoid COVID, masking and stuff like that. So maybe things are a little bit better right now. And it was, you know, of course, they got worse immediately.
And did you see that being politicized, what you were doing at that time?
I don't think so.
Not really?
I think we were all just
freaked out.
Yeah, the whole world was freaked out.
Yeah, except for the people who thought it was a scam and masks were bullshit.
Yeah, that happened pretty quick, like in Florida.
Yeah.
Like, were you just shocked it's the comics that were still doing shows in clubs during that time? I couldn't believe it.
They all got COVID.
Yeah, they did.
No comics I know died of it, though.
Oh, remember there was a comedy festival where several comedians got it at the festival and died?
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was like out of Indiana. Yeah.
No shit.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember.
But we also don't know what kind of brain fog people have. I mean, COVID has a long tail.
And you
right?
never got it?
Not yet.
Mm.
I mean, I do a lot to avoid it.
Yeah.
And I could have gotten an asymptomatic case, but my worry is long COVID.
Yeah.
Know?
I had it, I don't know, it's been a couple of years, I guess. Maybe February 2022.
Oh, so you had it, at least you had a vaxxed version of it, right?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Yeah, I was just tired and a little stuffy. It was a little weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, and your heart gets a little jacked.
Yeah. I mean, I have an aneurysm, so I don't want anything that causes blood clots.
Yeah.
So.
No, well, nobody wants to be sick.
I know, but I feel like I have to give an actual medical excuse.
Sure.
People go, I get it. Okay.
Well, there's just some nights, like, and I just knew, like, at some point, at the Comedy Store that I was going to get COVID.
I was just in Paris, Texas, and I'm like, if I survive this weekend, I'm bulletproof. This is ridiculous. And I did everything I could, but it was just so much coughing
just
in the audience.
Oh, yeah. Really? You heard the coughing?
Yeah. I mean, I bring an air purifier on stage when I'm headlining, you know, and I put it right
this
under me.
This is Paris, Texas?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
What the fuck is in Paris, Texas?
There's a comedy festival. I told you there's a festival everywhere.
All right.
Yeah.
How was that?
It was fun. It was fun.
Who were the headliners at the Paris Comedy?
It was me and Francisco Ramos, and then Gene Pompa, but he got COVID, I guess. So,
Gene Pompa, hey little bear.
But it's a rowdy road room, and definitely, you know, probably most people didn't vote the way I voted, but you know, I kind of like to play with that. You know,
went okay.
Yeah, it was fine. Yeah, the shows were really fun. Yeah, but again, I put an air purifier right in front of me. I blasted all the way up. My hair is often flying behind me when I perform, but so far so good.
It's so funny when I watch your stuff because I do like it's an angle on the idea of having to respect your parents or anything, for that matter.
Yeah,
I like it because I like I'm trying to work on this joke now about, you know, because both of my parents are, you know, kind of crapping out a bit. My dad certainly, my mom so much. And the joke is like, you know, it's weird when you get older and you have family. No one really tells you how much, you know, it's really going to cost to put your parents through dying.
Yeah,
and I think that's hilarious.
I do too.
But people, like, they kind of groan at it. But there is that zone of comedy where you know, you're mocking or making fun or making light of your mom's dying.
Yeah.
You know, in very, you know, structured joke ways.
Yeah.
But, and I think that because of that, because of your structure, people are able to afford you the distance. Do you know what I mean?
Because
they know it's a joke.
Yeah, a lot of them are almost joke jokes.
Which is good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because it's like one of the things I sort of run into is like I'm fairly conversational.
Yeah.
That's a joke and there's a couple of tags to it.
Yeah.
But you got to work them. Like, you know, when you first start doing those jokes, I have to assume the same way you were.
Oh, yeah.
Where people are like, what?
Exactly.
And you have to build the sort of the confidence and the groove of the thing.
Yeah.
And then it starts working. I don't know if it's detachment or what.
It is. That to me, always the important thing was like this chunk about my dad dying or my mom dying. Yeah. It has to be equally in weight equal to a joke about a chunk about me going shopping.
Right.
As a comic. Right. They are jokes about a thing.
Right.
And the audience has to feel comfortable. They have to know you're not going to start crying and that you're totally comfortable with it. It can take you years for me to say, especially with my dad died, like my throat could hardly make the words, right? And it took so long to get used to it and then going, well, that's a setup to a joke. And now this chunk's going to happen and the checks are going to drop.
Yeah.
People are going to be figuring out their tips while I'm talking about the one of the worst things that ever happened to me, and I have to be okay with it as a comic, right? And once you get there, then it's
great.
Like interchangeable Lego pieces in your act, you know?
And it also opens up this portal of possibilities.
Yeah.
You know, like, it took me a long time to get that stuff about Lynn passing to work.
Yeah.
But after I did, I realized, like, I didn't talk about anything.
Yeah, right.
Like, because now I'm doing a chunk about trauma, about childhood trauma. And I actually tell the audience, I say, okay, well, I'm going to go into this next piece, but I want you to know I can handle it.
That's perfect.
Whatever you guys experience is, it's your experience, but I'm okay. I'm okay with what I'm about to do.
That's great.
And it's kind of exciting.
Yeah.
Talk about that kind of stuff.
My son had told me something that happened to him at school.
Yeah.
And he goes, you can make a joke about it if you want. And I'm like, whoa. No, that's yours.
Yeah.
I'm not going. That's yours.
Right. Yeah.
It is weird.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
But was it upsetting what he told you?
Yeah, it was upsetting. Yeah. Yeah. You know, it was something he had to reckon with.
Really?
Yeah. But it was
but
like,
he wanted
that
you
was
to...
almost the first thing he said to me after he told me.
Yeah.
And I was like, what am I to you?
Maybe it helps him.
Premise seeking monster that had a child, you know?
No, he wanted you to make it easier.
Oh, I didn't think of it like that. The worst thing is I did think of a joke. And I feel really guilty about it. So I just, but.
I think he was looking for you to process it for him.
Interesting. I hadn't thought of it like that. I thought.
Because
he
knows
your
act,
doesn't
he?
I was a monster. Yeah, he does. He goes on the road with me sometimes. Yeah.
So, I mean, like, he's like, oh, she'll make it funny.
Oh.
Maybe it was a total compliment.
Maybe I'll tell him the joke I thought of.
How much time has passed?
Oh, since he told me, like a year.
Oh, yeah. You can definitely do it now. That's plenty of time. But what is it like with the kid? How old's the kid?
My son is 17 right now.
That's crazy.
It is. It is. It's like Felicia Michaels warned me that the teenage years would be just as time consuming as the other ones and in a different way. And they are, because you're constantly like monitoring their emotion, you know, their mood.
Yeah.
You know, are you okay? Like, you just read about things like teenagers.
Oh,
you know, you're like, the parents had no idea. And it's like, am I missing something? Is everything okay?
Yeah.
And should I be intervening now? And, you know, you quit doing this thing that you love. So should I say something or should I leave it? And I don't know what to do all the time.
The possibility for codependent insanity is, it's got to be just
it
crazy.
It is. And because my son was in lockdown for half of seventh grade and all of eighth grade.
Yeah.
Those were key years that he was at home the entire time.
Yeah.
And I think this is probably with a lot of parents. It depends on what age your kids were trapped with you. But like my son, I decked out his room. You know, I'm like, he's on Zoom. It's a nightmare. I just want him. I don't want him to lose. I want to keep as much education as possible. He's going to lose so much.
Yeah.
So, you know, he has like a space shuttle in his bedroom.
Yeah.
And now he doesn't want to leave. He's he's totally fine. And a lot of kids his age, too, like they don't hang out together. They just play games together. And they consider that hanging out, but they're not physically in each other's presence.
And that makes you nervous?
It doesn't make me nervous. It's just interesting. It's just different.
A little sad in a way.
Sad, but then they're okay with it, you know?
I guess. I just remember, like, that one of the great things about growing up without all that shit is you'd go out and hang out with a bunch of other kids.
I know.
And do nothing.
I know.
Like, when I was a little kid, you just go out in your front yard or on your street with some other kids on the street.
Ride bikes.
You just figure out how to hurt each other in a competitive way.
Yes, or girls in a backstabby way. But
yeah.
There's a lot of pain involved.
Yeah.
A lot of secret societies that you weren't allowed into unless you like ate dog food. That was happening on my street.
You mean guys making you eat dog food or mean girls making
you eat dog food? No, mean girls making you eat dog food to get into the
group.
And
then you'd be the only one that ate the dog
food. Yes, exactly.
I'm sorry you ate the dog food.
It wasn't bad. I mean,
it doesn't have much
I can't
flavor.
Survive as an old lady on cat food, I know, because I did eat dog food to get into
it. Doesn't have much flavor, oddly, does it?
It's just not that bad.
It's like a texture. Yeah. I got some in my mouth by accident. Yeah, so I don't know. But your kid's turning out okay?
Yeah, he loves animation. He wants to be an animator.
Oh, that's
so
good.
We're looking at art schools. We're looking at 2 years of community college because it's cheap, and then 2 years of art school.
Here?
I mean, hopefully. I don't know.
Like there's good places for that.
There's good places everywhere.
Oh, really?
We have citizenship in Luxembourg because of my great-great-grandmother.
Get out of here.
Yes. And so he could go to school in Europe. But, I mean, that's a big jump from the bedroom, the Zoom bedroom.
That'd be a good thing, though.
It would be a great thing if you did that. Yeah, it would be great to get out.
You got literally grandparented into Luxembourg?
Great-great-grandparented into Luxembourg.
Just one line of your family?
Helena Naff Lorge, yeah. One.
That's all it takes?
That's all it took. They have a generous reclamation process. Luxembourg does. It is very specific. You have to have had a relative that was born in Luxembourg in the 1800s and died in the U.S. after 1900. So she's the one that lived long enough. If she had died in 1899, we wouldn't have it.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
It's like I think about like countries that I could do that with if it was available to me, but they're not great. I'm like, I can always go back
Kazakhstan?
To Russia.
Oh, yeah.
I think Poland. I could get into Poland.
Poland's not bad.
Is it?
No, it's not. They just,
I think they did.
They
something
just had
came
some
around.
Referendum with their prime minister where they rejected fascism in a way that I was pleasantly surprised.
They were kind of drifting towards full fascist, weren't they?
Yeah. I mean, it's not Hungary. So, no, Poland's not bad. You should investigate.
I don't think I can.
Poland gets you into the whole EU.
But I don't think they offer that. I mean, my grandmother was born in Poland. And then
and did she
moved
leave
here.
Because of the Holocaust?
No, before.
But, I mean, the pressure? I mean, was she...
I don't know.
I don't know. I think there's an argument to be made.
Yeah. Maybe. I could say, yeah, so, she knew it was coming in 1923.
I mean, were things good in 1923?
No, they were never
Jewish
good.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it was okay because it went... There were borders that went from Ukraine to Poland. It was Galicia.
Yeah.
I don't even know where that is now, if it's in Poland or Ukraine. Because that border was a little fluid at some point in time,
yeah.
I think. But yeah, the Russians, yeah, it was either that. It's going to be Poland or Russia.
Well, if it's Poland, you're good. If you could do it, that would be great.
Mm. Yeah, you just have citizenship.
That's how the Luxembourg, one of the women that was running it, she's like, you can live in the south of France.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't know if I'll do that. If Luxembourg itself is very expensive,
yeah.
You know, but I would love to live somewhere in Europe for a year and just do one-nighters as a comic.
Really?
Yeah. If I could just pay my way, wow. I wouldn't have to make a profit.
The idea of going to a foreign country and doing comedy sometimes is sort of like, oh, my God.
There's so many English-speaking venues, and a lot of American comics go there. And I don't know, just like a triple run, but in France
That's
and
true.
Germany.
Yeah, I mean, I did that.
How amazing would that be?
I did that in Scandinavia.
Oh.
Like I did Norway.
Yeah.
I did Amsterdam, Oslo, Stockholm. Where have you performed over there?
In Europe?
Yeah.
Almost nowhere, just England. And I took my son to Ireland to throw my dad's ashes. And so I did a set in Dublin because I walked by a comedy club and I just contacted them.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, once my son graduates, things open back up for me.
Oh, yeah. You're going to go
crazy.
The
borders are slightly closed because I need to be, you know,
yeah, sure.
Once you
tuck him away
into
a school,
all the time. Yeah.
You can get out.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've done Dublin. England. I've done England.
Yeah.
Years ago, I went to Hong Kong and Beijing.
Wow.
There used to be a guy that booked
shows
there.
I remember that. I would be afraid to go to Beijing now. I'd be afraid you wouldn't get out, you know?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know if it was relatively scary.
Yeah.
I went with Russ Maniv. It was me and Russ Maniv.
He's so funny. I haven't seen him in a long time.
I might have
seen him at the Broadway a couple, maybe like a year or two ago.
We had a very good time. It was very funny.
What a one-liner guy.
He's very funny. Yeah. And it was all for expats. But I remember when we were in Beijing, we were there when that spy plane was taken.
Oh.
Like it had crashed and they had the spy plane.
Yeah.
And some of the people.
Yeah.
And we were told, you can't bring it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was intense.
That's your first instinct is to bring it up.
Sure, sure. Anybody have family on the... But I saw the Great Wall and I saw all that shit.
Wow.
And, it was kind of cool. Forbidden City.
Yeah.
But I didn't feel like... Yeah. Oddly, I didn't have great Chinese food there. I went to the original Peking duck place, which was now called the Beijing Duck, of course.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Right.
So, but it's okay.
Yeah.
Touristy, I guess. I didn't know the.
It's not
the,
what you can get.
I didn't know the hipster place. I'd still kind of like to go to India, but I don't know if I don't ever think.
Ooh.
Yeah, it just looks so crazy.
I mean, I know, but like once you, I mean, Mumbai or someplace like that.
That'd be overwhelming.
I want to do shows everywhere. I wish I had
that spirit.
Yeah.
I just want to go.
You don't want to do stand-up there? You want to visit?
No, the idea of worrying about doing a gig
and
what it's going to be like in Mumbai
is
too much for me. Because I feel like what I do is specific.
Yeah.
And that I have there's a certain amount of emotional investment and understanding that they'll understand me, outside of the jokes. I make myself a little crazy.
Do you look at the stats of who listens from where and go to
sometimes.
Those places?
No, not really.
No.
I know where I can. I'm good for about 800 people in most reasonable sized cities.
Right.
And from, 1,200 to a couple thousand in a few
cities. That's the dream.
Yeah, that's it.
Because you can still live a normal life. You know, I can't imagine what Jim Gaffigan's life is in an airport. It must be awful. People coming up to him all the time, right? And you can live a normal life, but you can sell out for people that already like you.
Yeah.
That's the comedy dream.
Yeah. My troubled fans is what I call
They might see you in the airport and write letters later, write emails to you.
But I feel like
Gaffigan's fans go right on up to him.
Well, yeah, because he's a big, funny guy.
Yeah, and he's approachable. And
he seems like
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
I don't know if he really is.
Well, no comic is who they are on stage, that's for sure.
Jimmy's he's definitely a little more intense. He's gotten more himself.
That's
like
good.
He, you know, he does more long form stuff. His last special was pretty dark. And
oh
pretty
yeah,
funny.
No, he's great. I'm just saying, like, I think his fans would
sure
would not hesitate well, to well, approach him, and I think the, yours would.
No, they come up to me.
Oh, they
but
do?
They know. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, they understand the thing because of how I do it. A lot of them really feel like they know me, and I think they do.
Yeah. Oh,
but,
yeah.
But most of them are aware that it's one sided. It's the ones that aren't quite aware of
right.
that becomes a little tricky.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know. But I don't know. You never did you? Are you still doing the podcast?
Yeah, I do. Has the Dork Forest, and ours is just called the Jackie and Laurie Show.
It's oh, how's
just
that going?
Me and Jackie Cation. We still do it. We find you know time every Sunday at some point. You know, we're usually logging in onto Zoom from hotels. And doing a
how's she doing?
Quick hour. She's doing great.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's working. I don't know. I feel like the industry wants both of us out, and we're both like, no, we're here. So you must reckon with us.
What industry?
Comedy, everything.
Really?
I don't know. That's how it feels.
But the weird thing is that I don't even see a semblance of an industry anymore.
I know, that's true.
And it just seems like, you know, some people have cobbled together enough of a following to go work.
I know.
And that's
I know.
It.
It is so, it's.
How's your draw? All right?
No, it's not. Well, I mean, it's okay. Hopefully the special will increase it, but it does feel like everyone's booking off of followers.
It's the worst.
I don't know. Like with some of the clubs, I'm like, are you doing anything? Do you even email your list
they don't.
To let them know? Or do we have to do it all?
Well, I think that is the problem, is that we do have to do it all.
Yeah.
And, you know, for those people who you are not connected that way or don't have that much juice or whatever, it's a real fucking challenge. But really, the clubs were never that great at it.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of maybe you could do morning radio and that might work.
Right.
I'm not even sure how anybody drew other than people knew them from television.
Yeah. Or, you know, they took out a newspaper ad and they saw it.
I guess
you know?
So, the newspaper ad. Right.
Yeah. But it. Yeah, no,
but like morning radio, that was the thing. And I don't even know how many people that drew.
I don't know either.
God damn it. I remember remember how many times we did Alex Bennett?
Oh, my God.
For what?
Oh, man.
No one gave a fuck about that shit. By the time I got there, you're just doing it. It's like this weird, you know, there's three comics there listening to Alex complain about his stomach or something.
He was great. I mean, I remember I was before I started doing comedy, I was listening to Bennett and I was cleaning houses, you know, and the
in SF?
No, in Lafayette. I was cleaning a house in Lafayette. It was a really nice house. And the father of the family was home.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize, or he came home, but I had used their speakers to jack up Alex Bennett. So I was clean all over the house and listening. It was like a house with speakers everywhere.
Yeah.
And Warren Thomas was being filthy.
Yeah.
And the dad walked in and I was like, oh, sorry. And I ran to turn it down.
Warren.
Yeah.
He was so funny.
Oh, my God. He was great.
How old were you when you started? What year was it?
I was 22. I started in 87.
So you were like there. I mean, I got there. When did I get there? Jesus.
Well, you came from
New York.
Boston. Yeah, right. You came around the same time. Like, I felt like Patton.
It was Patton and
in
Blaine.
In my head. And Blaine, that you guys all came from the East
Coast
at the
and it was
same
like,
time.
That was like 92-ish.
Probably. Dana Gould was already there, right?
He came long before, right?
Yeah.
So you were coming up in sort of that golden age a little bit.
A little bit, yeah.
Right? What was still left of it? Like, who was it? Slayton? Kevin
Slayton
Meaney.
Meaney was headline. Yeah, they were
Dana,
all there. Yeah, those were the headliners.
Was
Sue
DeGeneres?
Ellen was not there anymore.
Okay.
Sue Murphy.
Sue Murphy, yeah.
She was such a murderer.
Yeah, man.
Oh, my God. She killed so hard.
Kravitz?
Yes.
Was kind of around still?
Yeah, he was. Bob Rubin. Goldthwait.
The Rube. Yeah. Like, that was sort of like, you know, just post
Tom
the
Kenny?
Heyday.
Yeah.
Tom Kenny.
Yeah. Those
Bobby.
Were all the headliners.
Was Bobby.
Greg Proops, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was Bobby there? Goldthwait?
Or yes, he was. Yeah. Goldthwait was there. Yeah.
That's crazy. Mm-hmm. That was crazy time.
Yeah. And then they I don't know when they moved. Then the whole group left.
Moved to LA.
Yeah, to LA.
Well, yeah, that's because that's
groups
when.
Left. Yeah.
When we came in, everyone had gone. Like, Blaine and Patton and I arrived.
Yeah.
There was definitely a deficit.
Yeah, for sure.
And everyone had left except for Johnny Steele. And Carlos Alzaraki hadn't left yet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Carlos is down the street from me now.
He is?
Yeah.
He's a very nice guy.
Yeah, he's a great guy. He has two gorgeous daughters. And
oh, really?
Yeah.
These fucking people that end up with normal lives, I don't understand it.
I know, it's weird.
I couldn't manage it.
I mean, I have a semi-normal life, and it's strange to me, you know? And when my kid was born, I was like, good luck. I did my job. I gave birth to you, and now
I'm
like,
Is it normal, though? Like, you had the kid, and then the marriage broke up. And
it wasn't a marriage, but it was a relationship. Yeah,
and he was a comic.
Yes.
So there's nothing normal about
it. No, there's nothing normal about it. But he does go to a public school, you know?
No, other than, like, you're doing a good job as a single mom.
We'll see. Fingers crossed.
Sounds like you are.
I love him.
What's his relationship with the father? Good?
I think it's good.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I probably shouldn't, you know, get too much into any weeds on that. Yeah.
Well, good. All right. Well, it's good talking to you.
Yeah. Thanks for having me back.
Where's the special on?
It's called Sis Woke Grief Slut. It's on Apple TV, Amazon Prime. It's a comedy of dynamics, so they push it out. I remember doing a promo for Samsung TV Plus. It's probably on your microwave if you have. I don't know. It's like there's so many platforms now.
What's the whole thing?
Cis woke grief slut.
I like
CIS.
It. Yes.
As in.
Cis woke grief slut.
Yeah.
I just got an email that said my TV show, which is hard to find, is running on Viking cruise ships. Someone's like, I'm watching your show on Viking on a boat. And I'm like, what the fuck? It's like I did my last special with HBO, which isn't really international.
Yeah.
Until it gets to Sky TV or whatever their affiliates are.
Right.
So like no one could see it in Europe unless they flew on a certain airline. Like people are like, oh, what's your special on the flight?
Well, you're finally a cruise ship comic.
Mark. Yes, it took a long time, and I'm happy to know that I made it.
Sure.
All right. Well, I liked the special. I loved it.
Oh, thanks so much. Thanks for watching it.
There you go. Lori Kilmartin. Her special is out now. Cis Woke Grief Slut is on all major video on demand platforms. Hang out for a minute, folks. Okay, look, you guys, listen. On Thursday, John Oliver is back. The last time he was on was way back in 2012, episode 298.
Your mother taught what?
Music.
Really?
Yeah.
Like what did she play? Piano?
Yeah, she played piano. She played cello.
Do you play piano?
No. Well, not really. I played the violin.
You played the violin?
Yeah.
So you were really pulled in two directions, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, because I played on all the school sports teams, and I did drama and music as well. So I was the one thing that floated between those two worlds. So I would turn up to, like, rehearsals for things with, you know, mud and blood on me.
Yeah.
And I would turn up to, you know, sporting events with a violin case. Yeah. Imagine which of those was more difficult. You can wash the blood off. You cannot make that violin case disappear.
It's too bad that your parents weren't more strict and made you play the violin, because then you could have might have been a sports star.
Oh, no, they kind of did make me play the violin.
And your contempt for that didn't drive you harder into sport?
Or maybe I went as hard into sport as I could.
So you just not,
but I had physical. I wasn't good enough.
You just weren't good enough.
I can't even believe I'm saying that out loud. Yeah. Now. But I wasn't good enough. By I was never going to make my career as a professional footballer.
Well, and like exactly what year did you realize that?
Probably about 3 years ago.
So it's still raw. It's still fresh.
Yeah, I'm sorry, man.
You can listen to that full episode along with all WTF episodes ad-free by signing up for WTF Plus. Just go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. Oh, and I just want to tell you that the new John Oliver episode, fun, hilarious. It was a good time. And I don't always have those. Here's some guitar from the vaults.
Boomer lives, Monkey and LaFonda, cat angels everywhere. Jesus told me so.